We're going to continue now with tonight's archive show, The Flight of the Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. Having taken a look at the serious flaws in the official Soviet account of Adolf Hitler's death, or quote, death, unquote, as presented by KGB operative Lev Bezymensky, we're now going to take a look at the enormous flaws in the best-known Western history of Hitler's death. This is the very well-known Last Days of Hitler, put out by former MI6 operative Sir Hugh Trevor Roper. Once again, this particular article comes from the Military Advisor. This comes from the Military Advisor, the publication for international military hobbyists and historians. The Military Advisor issue of summer 1990, volume 1, number 3. And this story is called The Genesis of the Last Days. This is also authored by Gregory Douglas, who has authored the series of articles that we're dealing with in tonight's program. And this deals with the enormous flaws in the official version of Hitler's demise as presented by Hugh Redwald Trevor Roper, a student at Oxford for a period of time, and then later an operative for British MI6. Also an individual who was deeply involved with the Soviet spy ring of Kim Philby, Anthony Blunt, and others. After a discussion of Trevor Roper's acquaintance with those individuals and some of the operations they were involved in, Gregory Douglas writes as follows of Trevor Roper and his official version of Hitler's death. He claimed that he had conducted, quote, numerous, unquote, interviews with former members of Hitler's staff. But the fact that most of the key personnel, such as Otto Günsche, G-U-Umlaut-N-S-C-H-E, Hitler's orderly officer, Heinz Linge, L-I-N-G-E, Hitler's longtime valet, and Hans Bauer, B-A-U-R, Hitler's chief pilot, were in Soviet custody, where they made documented statements directly opposed to Trevor Roper's findings, coupled with Trevor Roper's admitted unfamiliarity with spoken German, has rendered his book, The Last Days of Hitler, unquote, highly suspect in factual content, if not in its well-polished context. As a result of this work, a self-perpetuating series of myths has become well-established in historical circles, and Hugh Redwald Trevor Roper automatically became the original source from which an army of subsequent writers copiously copied. He quickly assumed the mantle of the leading expert on the subject of Adolf Hitler, and no self-respecting work on the German leader was complete without a skillfully crafted foreword by Trevor Roper. Blunt, that's Anthony Blunt, a British intelligence operative and also Soviet spy. Blunt became keeper of the Queen's pictures and was knighted for his governmental services, while Trevor Roper was made King's Professor of History at Oxford, and in 1979 raised to the peerage as Lord Dacre, D-A-C-R-E, of Glanton, G-L-A-N-T-O-N. The next section of Gregory Douglas's article illustrates how Trevor Roper's reputation as an expert on the Third Reich was badly tarnished as a result of his vouching for the spurious Hitler diaries in the early 1980s. Of this episode, Gregory Douglas writes, on April 8th, 1963, Lord Dacre, the man who believed he had, quote, a patent on Adolf Hitler, unquote, flew to Zurich at the request of newspaper publisher Rupert Murdoch to authenticate the now notorious, quote, Hitler diaries, unquote. Although possessed with keen intellect and sharp wit, Trevor Roper was also blessed with a monumental ego which overrode the basic fact that he was not fluent in German and certainly could not read a word of the old-style German script that Hitler wrote in. Following the Zurich visit, which entailed a very cursory examination of unintelligible script, Trevor Roper returned to England and solemnly announced that, quote, I am now satisfied that the documents are genuine, unquote. A subsequent thorough investigation by experts from the German National Archives quickly disclosed that the documents were not only not genuine, but, quote, crude forgeries, unquote, by, quote, someone of limited intelligence, unquote. It would be a secure assumption following this debacle that Trevor Roper's, quote, patent on Adolf Hitler, unquote, has finally expired. And next, the author, Gregory Douglas, goes on to cite some major, major flaws in Hugh Trevor Roper's thesis, namely the fact that some of the people to which he attributes his evidence never existed at all, at least according to SS records, and that others at the time that he was supposedly gleaning information from them were in Soviet custody making statements directly contradictory to what Trevor Roper says they communicated to him. Gregory Douglas's analysis of the flaws in Trevor Roper's work. In Trevor Roper's Last Days of Hitler, very heavy emphasis for the suicide cremation theory is placed on statements and alleged statements from a number of SS personnel allegedly involved in the last act. Hitler's SS orderly, Otto Günsche, Hitler's valet, Heinz Linke, a member of Hitler's special SS bodyguard, Hermann Karnow, and another bodyguard member, Erich Mansfeld, M-A-N-S-F-E-L-D, were all alleged to have participated in the removal of Hitler and Eva Braun's bodies from the bunker and their subsequent cremation in the Chancellery Garden. Since Günsche and Linge, along with Hans Bauer, Hitler's chief pilot, were in a Soviet prison camp and not available for interview when Trevor Roper wrote his official report, statements attributed to them should be taken with extraordinary caution, if not skepticism. Hermann Karnow, K-A-R-N-O-W, stated to be an SS member of the RSD, the Dienststelle 1, Hitler's special police guard, was apparently interviewed by Trevor Roper and claimed that he saw Hitler's body burning in the garden. Unfortunately, extensive and careful post-war examination of SS files fails to locate any Hermann Karnow, and an equally extensive search of RSD records and SS rank lists indicates that there was no such person in the RSD. Therefore, not only was there no Hermann Karnow in the RSD, but also no such person in the entire SS. Erich Mansfeld, again M-A-N-S-F-E-L-D, or Skrpizy, S-K-R-Z-I-P-Z-P-C-Z-Y, as Trevor Roper also calls him, was not in the RSD either, according to the evidence of the same official SS lists. It would be fair to assume that when the British official report was prepared, the SS personnel files and records were not available, and no doubt Trevor Roper may be excused his lapses on the grounds that he was unaware that he was interviewing non-existent people. However, there is no question of the existence of Günsche, Linge, and Bauer. Since they too are used as direct sources for the Viking funeral theory outside the bunker, let us consider certain recently disclosed information. In a U.S. Counterintelligence Corps document of November 15, 1948, Throughman Report, T-H-R-O-U-G-H-M-A-N Report, 0933-034, Günsche stated to the senior Wehrmacht medical officer and commander of all military hospitals in besieged Berlin that, quote, "I did not see the dead Führer. These things were done without us," unquote. Bauer said at the same time that he had not seen the bodies either, and Linge, who was alleged to have assisted in carrying the bodies of Hitler and his wife up the bunker exit stairs, said that, quote, "He did not see the body of the dead Führer," unquote. The debriefing of these SS members following their return from the Soviet imprisonment produced similar statements. So again, the main criticism, and it is a profound criticism, of Trevor Roper's thesis. First of all, it should be noted that he hardly has a patent on Adolf Hitler, as his incorrect identification of the Hitler diary forgeries indicates. Beyond that, many of the people that he was drawing direct information from about the cremation of Adolf Hitler were at the time in Soviet prison. They were in Soviet detention, and they were making statements contradictory to what Trevor Roper says they were saying, or at least they made those statements after they were released from Soviet imprisonment. And indeed, according to U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps documents, at least one of them, Günsche stated, who was Hitler's personal orderly, stated to a Wehrmacht medical officer they did not see the dead Führer, whereas he was cited by Trevor Roper as an evidentiary source for that very same, quote, dead Führer. Beyond that, at least two of the people identified as major sources by Trevor Roper, according to Gregory Douglas, do not have any records existing in the SS and RSD records. As he puts it rather unkindly, perhaps Trevor Roper was unaware that he was interviewing non-existent people. If they did exist, there is no record of their ever having been in the units that they were supposedly in. Obviously, I think the flaws in Trevor Roper's work here are rather apparent under the circumstances. Hardly what one would call airtight scholarship. Beyond that, one of the people that Trevor Roper identifies as having been killed having had his body discovered along with the body of the Führer is SS General Hermann Fegelein, F-E-G-E-L-E-I-N. And Fegelein's was one of the names on the manifest that was discovered for people that were going to be leaving on Adolf Hitler's transport. We're going to get to that list of people scheduled to depart on Hitler's transport, which did in fact land in Barcelona, Spain. We're going to talk about that in the next article. But of the, quote, death, unquote, of Fegelein, as reported by Hugh Trevor Roper, Gregory Douglas writes as follows. In the first part of this series, the name of SS General Hermann Fegelein appears as a proposed passenger on the Horsung to Barcelona flight of Hitler's personal transport. Trevor Roper, in contradiction, states that Fegelein was shot in the Chancellery Garden on Hitler's orders on the evening of April 28th. Proceeding on this assumption, therefore, it would hardly have been possible for Fegelein to have flown to Barcelona 2 days earlier. A careful inspection of Hermann Fegelein's files, now located at Fort Meade, Maryland, Intelligence and Security Command, depicts a somewhat different scenario than the one put forward by Trevor Roper. According to an official Counterintelligence Corps report of September 21, 1945, Walter Hirschfeld, H-I-R-S-C-H-F-E-L-D, a Jewish refugee from Vienna and then an agent for the CIC, was in close contact with Hans Fegelein, then resident in Munich and the father of Hermann. According to the Hirschfeld report, Hermann Fegelein had been in contact with his father after the war and reported that, quote, the Führer and I are safe and well, unquote, and that he would try to get in contact with his family if possible. The name of Hermann Fegelein appears 3 years later in another Counterintelligence Corps report, this one under the heading of Venter's Report, Roman numeral 8-12203 of November 30th, 1948. Quote, Soviet efforts have been directed towards discovering the whereabouts of Hitler, Bormann, and former SS General Fegelein. The Soviet view that these leaders fled from Berlin in April or May of 1945 and are being harbored in the West has been officially and strongly denied by careful coordination of all Western agencies concerned, unquote. As we shall see, wherever they were being sheltered, they certainly were not, in fact, casualties in Berlin at the end of the war, and certainly whether or not they were being sheltered by the West, Western intelligence agencies were employing some of the people who had effected their escape. Continuing. SS General Heinrich Müller, who signed the orders for KG-200, but that, by the way, is the transportation squadron of which that Junkers 290A6, Hitler's personal transport, was a part. SS General Heinrich Müller, who signed the orders for KG-200, was stated officially to have died in the last battles of Berlin and buried in the military cemetery at Kreuzberg. Müller's death certificate, STA Berlin Mitte NR 11706/45, indicates the time and place of death, and the Müller grave does in fact exist. In 1963, West German authorities had sufficient reason to believe that Müller was not in his grave, and on September 29, 1963, the Berlin Staatsanwalt's office officially opened the grave. A subsequent pathologist's report proved that bits and pieces of three different people, none of which belonged to Müller, were found in the grave. A sentence from a CIC report dated November 30th, 1948, states on page 1, paragraph 9, quote, former SS General Müller has proven to be of genuine worth and his intelligence files of tremendous value, unquote. Medical and dental forensics now play an important part in the determination of death. In 1963, the examination of physical remains proved that Müller was not resting in his grave in the Kreuzberg Cemetery. What about the dental forensics often reported as proving beyond a doubt that Hitler and Eva Braun's bodies had been positively identified? Well, we've taken a look at that already, and once again, all of the medical records, all of the dental records, I should say, for Hitler and the other Third Reich leaders vanished. They have never been found. And the purported identification based on sketches drawn from memory by Dr. Blaschke, a committed member of the SS, are obviously subject to question as a result of that. Certainly Blaschke was not an objective observer, not a mere medical or dental technician. He was a dedicated member of the SS. And again, the records which would be required to effect a positive identification have never turned up. And the circumstances in the Bezemensky account would indicate a profound lack of awareness of exactly what had transpired with regard to the dental records of the Third Reich leaders. They vanished in late April of 1945. They have never been found. Obviously, in the article we just took a look at, Hugh Trevor Roper's account of Hitler's demise is also open to very serious question. In the first place, he does not speak German. In the second place, his incorrect identification of the Hitler diaries calls into question his expertise with regard to Adolf Hitler, Beyond that, many of the sources that Hugh Trevor Roper drew upon were in fact in Soviet custody at the time, and when they were released, they made statements contradictory to what Hugh Trevor Roper says they were claiming. Beyond that, and even more importantly, at least two of the major sources relied on for Hugh Trevor Roper have never had their very existence determined. There are no records of such people ever having existed in the SS. Obviously, that seriously calls into question Hugh Trevor Roper's thesis. Beyond that, he identifies General Hermann Fegelein as having been shot on Hitler's orders 2 days before Fegelein appeared. Fegelein's name appears on a manifest of people to leave on Hitler's personal transport on April 26th of 1945. Beyond that, there are U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps documents from after the war in which Fegelein's father was receiving correspondence from Fegelein indicating that both he and Hitler were alive and well. Obviously, that also seriously calls into question Hugh Trevor Roper's account that Fegelein had been executed on Hitler's orders 2 days earlier. The next article that we're going to look at, also from the same publication, and research credit on this goes to the same listener. This is from the Military Advisors issue of Spring of 1990, Volume 1, Number 2. Again, so this publication is subtitled, The Publication for International Military Hobbyists and Historians. And this is yet another article dealing with the, quote, demise, unquote, of Adolf Hitler by that very same author, Gregory Douglas. This was called, this article is entitled, JU-290A6, The History and the Mystery, by Gregory Douglas. And as we skip down into this article, we find that it reads, after a discussion of the development of this particular aircraft, the JU-290, which was envisioned as having a number of different roles, from a large transport to a patrol aircraft, the particular version of it that we're talking about here, there was only one of them produced, and that was as Adolf Hitler's personal transport. Skipping down into the article, Gregory Douglas writes, of the entire JU-290 series, the most historically significant was the Sol A-6. This aircraft was conceived and built at Bernberg, B-E-R-N-B-E-R-G, as a special high-pressure personal transport for Adolf Hitler. The A-6, which carried the identification codes of KR plus LP, had the Junkers Works number of 0185 and was completed in late 1943. A special feature of this custom Führer transport was an armored seat lined with 13 millimeters of steel plate and containing a built-in parachute. The seat was designed to fall free from the aircraft by activating a hydraulic handle. Tests with dummies were successfully conducted at the time of installation. In addition to the armored ejection seat, the aircraft's windows were of bulletproof glass. In addition to the armored ejection seat, the aircraft's windows were of bulletproof glass, 50 millimeters thick in the area where Hitler sat, was protected by additional armor plating on the roof, sides, and floor of the fuselage. The completed A-6 was entered on the rolls of the Regierungsstaffel as Immelmann 4, that's Regierungsstaffel. All of Hitler's earlier personal aircraft, to include a Roland, a JU-52, and FW-200 Condor, were given the name of the famous World War I German ace. In late 1944, KRLP was transferred from Prague to Finsterwalde, an airfield south of Berlin, where it was added to the strength of 1KG-200. This squadron was initially formed in 1943 from the Versuchsverband, OBDL, or Research Units of the CIC, Luftwaffe. That's Versuchsverband. The one group was not, however, under the command of the Luftwaffe, but rather the RSHA, or Reichssicherheitshauptamt, the SS parent organization which controlled, among other departments, the Gestapo and SD. 1KG-200, or IKG-200, was under the leadership of 30-year-old Hauptmann Heinz Braun, B-R-A-U-N, and at the end of the war was used solely for escape flights of high NSDAP personages. Again, the NSDAP is the German Nazi Party. Last sentence again, IKG-200 was under the leadership of 30-year-old Hauptmann Heinz Braun, and at the end of the war was used solely for escape flights of high NSDAP personages. In early 1945, Oberst Baumbach, B-A-U-M-B-A-C-H, a well-decorated and competent bomber officer, was made Commodore of the squadron and then in April given the additional command of the Reichsgruppenstaffel, or Hitler's personal aircraft. On the 20th of April, 1945, Hitler's 56th birthday, a major exodus of top Third Reich leaders from threatened Berlin began. On the same day, SS General Heinrich Müller, chief of the Gestapo, issued a top-secret order from his headquarters in Berlin. It was an instruction to Oberst Baumbach and the commanding officer of IKG-200 that a special flight would leave the KG-200 base at Einring-Hersching, located some 17 kilometers southwest of Linz-Donau, on April 26, 1945. Once again, the spelling on that, Einring, A-I-N-R-I-N-G, Hersching, H-O-E-R-C-H-I-N-G. So again, this particular unit, called I or 1KG-200, was not under the command of the Luftwaffe, but the SS, specifically the RSHA, and it was under the specific command the actual military commander of the unit was Heinz Braun, but it was under the direction, it was under the control of SS General Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo. And he authorized that a special flight would leave the KG-200 base at Einring-Hersching. Continuing with Gregory Douglas's account, a copy of Baumbach's top secret orders, along with several other similar and related documents, is published here for the first time. Hitler's transport landed at Barcelona on April 27th, disembarked its passengers, and was left on the airfield where the German air attaché arranged for it to be turned over to the Spanish government of General Franco. The pilot and crew returned to Germany. Hitler's Ju-290 eventually formed a part of Escuela Superior de Vuelo and was finally scrapped in 1956. The special armored seat was removed from the aircraft soon after it landed in Barcelona. All that remains now of KRLP is this armored chair and a polished wood folding table. What also remains to tantalize historians are a collection of orders, official reports, and post-war Allied and Spanish documents lodged in obscurity in dusty archives available to anyone who takes the time and has the interest to depart from the well-trodden path of known history. And photostats of these documents are indeed included in this particular article. And these are the copies of the orders that were issued by General Müller for this particular flight. And I'll read this first document here. It says, secret command matter, top secret only by officer. It's from Heinrich Müller, SS General, Lieutenant General of Police, Berlin, 20th of April, 1945. And this is the first of three copies. Subject, special Führer journey to Barcelona. By the way, I would note that as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 37, specifically in the September 20th, 1992 episode of same, and I reprised this material last week, incidentally, the Third Reich's plans to go underground entailed the seat of the Nazi Party in exile to be in Spain, and that is where it was set up, and as the information that was developed pursuant to the Naumann coup indicated, and it is to Spain and to Barcelona that this flight of Hitler's personal transport took place. Now, whether or not the people that were ordered to be on it were in fact on it, and the indications are that they were, remains to be determined, but certainly it is a matter of record that Hitler's personal transport did indeed leave Berlin on the evening of April 26th, and a Spanish police report from the 27th describes some of the things that were on that plane, including a dog which was apparently a German Shepherd dog, which may have been Hitler's dog. The one that was discovered in the Chancellery was not apparently Blondie. More about the orders here. There's a photostat of the original document in German. I'm reading the translation. The Führer and the escort, it says, subject, special Führer journey to Barcelona. 1. The Führer and his escort will leave the airfield at Hersching on 26th of April, 1945 at 8 p.m. Herewith is a list of those escorting the Führer. The Führer, Minister of State Dr. Goebbels, he was then stricken from the list, he's crossed out. Mrs. Goebbels and 6 children also crossed out. State Leader Bormann, SS General Müller, SS General Fegelein, General of Infantry Bergdorf, Ambassador for Special Use Havel, SS Lieutenant Colonel Betz, B-E-T-Z, SS Major Dr. Stumpfeger, SS Captain Gross, Miss Brown, and Miss Manziali, M-A-N-Z-I-A-L-Y, Four-Man Escort Command National Security Service. The baggage of the above-named gentlemen should be given over to the headquarters of the Hershing Airfield up to 4 p.m. Then there's more information at the bottom about who this was going to. Distribution, Colonel Baumbach, Head of Government Flight Staff, 1st Group Bomber Squadron 200, Commander State Leader Borman. As we shall see in the next article that we're going to read, not all of these people were, in fact, on that plane. But note here that the orders, and the orders are reproduced, would indicate that General Fegelein was to be on this plane. And according to Hugh Trevor Roper, Fegelein was executed 2 days before he was to be on the plane, raising questions about why his name would appear on the orders at all. Whether or not Hitler was actually on that plane, and the indications are that he left Berlin on April 27th, whether he was all on that plane or whether the plane left with other people or with some loot, some of the booty of the Third Reich, remains to be determined. But certainly Hitler and a number of other top Third Reich leaders were scheduled to be on that plane. The plane did fly on the day that it was supposed to have flown. More about the strange flight of JU-290A6 in the same Gregory Douglas article. On the 22nd of April, 1945, 2 days after Adolf Hitler's 56th birthday and the beginning of the exodus of top Third Reich leaders from Berlin, Reichsleiter Martin Bormann sent the following top-secret telex from the Führerhauptquartier to his secretary, SS Major Dr. Helmut von Hummel on the Ober-Salzburg. That's H-E-L-M-U-T-H-V-O-N, capital H-U-M-M-E-L. In German it reads, I'll do my best, Hummel Ober-Salzburg, bin mit vorgeschlagener Übersee seit einverstanden Bormann. Translation, agree to proposed overseas south transfer, unquote. And Douglas goes on to comment, SS Sturmbannführer Dr. Helmut von Hummel was Bormann's private secretary with offices in Munich and on the Ober-Salzburg. He was appointed to this position in October of 1942 and was in direct control of the entire Führer complex as well as controller of all of Hitler's private funds. The post-war discovery of this provocative secret telex has caused considerable controversy as to its meaning. A Soviet historian claims that an overseas South transfer indicates an escape plan with South America as a probable goal. A German writer and editor of Stern magazine of the Hitler Diary fame claims with authority that overseas South refers only to the transfer of NSDAP records, quote, from Munich to Straubing on the Übersee, a Bavarian lake. Unfortunately for this thesis, Straubing, located 113 kilometers northeast of Munich, is located on the Danube River, and no such Bavarian lake exists. Übersee means overseas, and Sud means south, and the NSDAP archives were still in Munich at the end of the war. On the 30th of April, 1945, 9 days before the end of the war in Europe, and the date of the orders for the last KG-200 flight from Hershing to Barcelona, a special box 4 feet long and weighing over 100 pounds was turned over to Dr. Hummel at his office in Berchtesgaden by officials of the Sonderauftrag Linz, unquote. This organization had been set up in 1939 to assemble collections of fine art for Hitler's projected museum complex in his former home of Linz, Donau. Skipping down, after an accounting of art treasures that may very well have been in this box that went out on the last KG-200 flight to Barcelona, the author comments, all of this artwork and the probable treasures vanished from the rolls of the Linz project, leaving behind copies of the coin and stamp inventories which promptly vanished into the secret archives of the victorious Allies. It is from these archives that the final answers to the mystery of the disappearance of Adolf Hitler, members of his staff, and much of his personal treasure have come to light. And indeed, as I said, the documents are reproduced, both the original German documents and also their American translations. And as we have seen, there was a proposal to have a number of people on this particular flight that left Germany 4, Barcelona, Spain, which, as we have seen in past broadcasts, including RFA 37, was in fact, as the Nazis had proposed to do during the war, had become the seat of the Nazi government in exile. That is to say, Spain was the seat of the Nazi government in exile, a very friendly climate under fascist dictator Francisco Franco. And as we have seen here, the very last of the KG-200 flights, which went to Barcelona, may very well have had some of this artwork and some of the treasures that had been secreted by Adolf Hitler. And then note, too, the German writer from Stern, who attempted to mislead with regard to what these orders were indicating, indicating that this simply referred to NSDAP records that were transferred from Munich to a Bavarian lake, whereas, in fact, they meant no such thing. So, again, that flight, that plane did, in fact, take off from the Hershing Airfield, H-O-E-R-C-H-I-N-G. It landed in Barcelona, Spain, and among the people who were supposed to have been on that plane were Adolf Hitler, Eva Braun, and a bunch of other people from the inner circle of Adolf Hitler at the Chancellery. And note again that Hermann Fegelein was one of the people who was supposed to be on that plane. That casts serious doubts on the veracity of Hugh Trevor Roper's claim that, in fact, Hermann Fegelein had been shot on Hitler's orders 2 days earlier. What we're going to do now is take another break, and when we come back, we're going to take a look at the last and longest of these articles, and we're going to take a look, first of all, at SS General Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, the individual who was oversaw the functions of a KG-200, the squadron of aircraft that included Hitler's personal aircraft, and it was one of those planes that landed in Barcelona on April 27th, and it was proposed that Hitler, among others, be on that particular plane. Well, Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, went to work for U.S. intelligence in an as yet undetermined capacity after World War II, and it was Heinrich Müller who arranged the details for the escape of Adolf Hitler, and in fact he revealed those details in a debriefing of Heinrich Müller that was performed by U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps agents, and it is from the documents stemming from that debriefing that our discussion of Adolf Hitler and his escape from Berlin that's where the discussion will be coming from. That's where the documentation will be coming from. All of that after a break here on One Step Beyond. This is entitled The Flight of the Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. We have taken a look at information which casts serious, serious doubt on the veracity both of the official Soviet version of what happened to Adolf Hitler, the Bezemensky account, allegedly depending upon dental records, which were obviously removed and have never surfaced since. The author Bezemensky appears to be seriously ignorant of what actually happened with the dental records of the leaders of the Third Reich. And beyond that, there are serious questions about what actually happened to the corpses supposedly discovered by the Soviets. Beyond that, as we've seen, the official Western version by Hugh Trevor Roper is seriously flawed. It relies on documentation or on evidence presented by men in Soviet custody who were apparently giving information contradictory to what Hugh Trevor Roper maintains. Beyond that, at least two of his major sources are people of whom there is no trace. There is no record of these people ever having been in the SS. So it is highly questionable how Trevor Roper could have interviewed people of whom there is no record in the first place. Beyond that, obviously, Hermann Fegelein, the general that was supposedly shot on Adolf Hitler's orders 2 days before he was listed as scheduled to depart with Hitler on a plane, a transport plane which did, in fact, land in Barcelona, Spain on April 27th, 1945. As we shall see in the last installment of this article, the individual who was in charge, the last installment of this archive show, I should say, the individual who was in charge with the supervision of that squadron, not its actual flight leader, but the squadron of which that JU-290A6 was part, namely Heinrich Müller, an SS general and head of the Gestapo, was the individual who arranged Adolf Hitler's escape from Berlin at the end of April of 1945, specifically on April 22nd of 1945. As we shall see, this information was disclosed by Heinrich Müller to agents of the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps and also people working for the newly formed CIA. This one, he was being debriefed by these operatives in 1948 prior to going to work for U.S. intelligence. And as we shall see, what Heinrich Himmler, what Heinrich Mueller, excuse me, and his cohorts did was to get a double of Adolf Hitler, a distant relative of Hitler's who was actually a virtual double for Adolf Hitler. And it was that individual who was sedated and then killed in the courtyard of the Chancellery. That was the person they found, not the Führer himself, but a double who had been groomed by the SS to stand in for Adolf Hitler and who stood in for Adolf Hitler when he gave his final bow, or what was represented as his final bow. Research credit on this article goes to that very same listener, and this is from the article, this is the bulk of the article with which we began tonight's program. This is from the Military Advisor, the publication for international military hobbyists and historians from the winter of 1992-93. This is volume 4, number 1, and this article is entitled Flight of the Wolf, Berlin, 1945, and this also is by Gregory Douglas, the author of the other articles in this series. The article begins, in September of 1963, the West Berlin Public Prosecutor's Office exhumed the corpse of Heinrich Mueller, former SS general and chief of the Gestapo. Mueller's death certificate showed that he was killed in Berlin in 1945 and buried in the Kreuzberg Cemetery. The prosecutor's office was acting on information indicating that Mueller had survived the war. The post-mortem proved that the remains in the grave were of several different people and were not those of Heinrich Mueller. The chief of the Gestapo's name was added to a long list of high-level Third Reich personalities who disappeared in 1945. Martin Bormann, secretary to the Führer, Glücks, G-L-U-U-M-N-A-U-T-C-K-S, head of the concentration camp system, SS General Fegelein, F-E-G-E-L-E-I-N, Himmler's representative at Hitler's military headquarters, Ambassador Walter Havel, H-E-W-E-L, Ribbentrop's representative to Hitler, and Hitler himself. In 1980, all of Heinrich Mueller's personal papers surfaced in Switzerland, where he had lived after the war. Also included in these papers were complete microfilms of Hitler's personal files that Mueller had microfilmed for him in the last month of the war. It is now known what happened to Mueller and a number of those who vanished at the same time and place. The entire file contains documents and references to personalities and events that can only be termed historically explosive. The following article is based entirely on Mueller's Mueller's personal files, but represents only a small fragment of the boxes of papers now being edited for future publication. So information here from Heinrich Mueller's personal files, microfilmed during the last month of the war, also from Adolf Hitler's files. And bear in mind that some of the information that you're going to be hearing during the course of the reading of this article is from a debriefing of Heinrich Mueller, again, the head of the Gestapo, by operatives of U.S. intelligence who were debriefing him prior to putting him to work for U.S. intelligence. And it is in the context of the forces that were at work in 1945 that the real significance of tonight's broadcast, the political and historical significance, can be seen. Basically, those forces that were working to obfuscate what actually happened to Adolf Hitler are the forces which are in control of the world today, just as the people who helped to cover up Adolf Hitler's survival in 1945 did so in order to hide the circumstances of his escape. Again, he was basically his escape, Hitler's escape, was affected by Heinrich Mueller, the head of the Gestapo, and the head of the Gestapo went to work for U.S. intelligence after World War II, as did many of the worst criminals of the Third Reich, and indeed the Reinhard Gehlen Eastern Front spy outfit that I talk about so often on this program, a direct projection forward of Third Reich intelligence and of the Third Reich's general staff mentality and strategy. That organization basically was installed at the core of the U.S. intelligence system and at the very core of NATO itself. It could said very accurately to have been a manifestation of the very same forces that can be seen here in this article, putting the head of the Gestapo to work for Western intelligence. And it is in the context of the powers that were in that were holding sway in 45 and that hold sway today that the cover-up of the fate of Adolf Hitler can be seen. Indeed, Hitler escaped. In and of itself, not an important event, but it is very important in that the reason why it was covered up to a considerable extent is that the people who served Adolf Hitler, the people who carried out his political will, as well as the people who helped him escape, who actually physically handled his escape, went to work for U.S. intelligence after the war, and that was too controversial to be disclosed to the light of day in 1945, and in considerable measure, that necessitated a cover-up of the entire scenario, including the relatively unimportant escape of Hitler personally. That Hitler survived is not in and of itself important, but the people who served Hitler, the people who carried out his policies, the people who believed in him, not only survived World War II, but they were installed at the very core of U.S. intelligence after World War II, and they were installed at the very core of NATO itself, and they exerted a profound, a pivotal influence on the course of world events since the end of World War II. I refer interested listeners to, above all other archive shows, Radio Free America 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. We're going to continue now with Gregory Douglass's account of how Heinrich Müller went to work for U.S. intelligence following World War II, and how he helped the escape of Adolf Hitler. There is a synoptic account of Gregory Douglass's criticisms of the Bezemensky and Hugh Trevor Roper works that we dealt with earlier in tonight's broadcast. I'm going to present his summation of his criticisms of Bezemensky and of Trevor Roper without comment. They speak for themselves, and we've already covered this in the previous installments. By his own efforts, Trevor Roper had established himself as the premier expert on Hitler, and it was the rare publication on the life of the Führer that was not, graced by a polished and entertaining foreword from his accomplished pen. When the fake Hitler diary surfaced in Germany in the early 1980s, Trevor Roper at once authenticated them for the owner of the London Times, for whom he worked. When it was later discovered that the diaries were prepared by a jovial forger at the request of the East German Committee for State Security, or Stasi, for the dual purpose of embarrassing the West German government and to obtain badly needed foreign currency for their operations, the collapse of the historical House of Cards brought down heavy debris not only on the heads of the world media, but also on the balding pate of Trevor Roper. In the ensuing investigations, the fact that Trevor Roper, the premier expert on Hitler, could not read, write, nor speak German, with the exception of a few words, coupled with his eagerness to authenticate a ludicrous fraud for his employer, combined to topple him from his self-constructed pedestal. Because of his initial report, Trevor Roper had been unhesitatingly accepted by both the publishing and academic worlds as a matter of convenience. Given these circumstances, the questioning of the legitimacy of the foundation of his fame, the initial intelligence report later published as The Last Days of Hitler, would certainly be imperative in ascertaining the truth surrounding the disappearance of Adolf Hitler in the month of April 1945. By thoroughly checking the author's alleged factual statements with presently available German and American records, the intelligence report and the subsequent book based on it show inexcusable errors which emerge like fungus in wet wood. Dr. David Marwell, M-A-R-W-E-L-L, head of the U.S. State Department-controlled Berlin Document Center, made a thorough search of the records under his control and could find no trace whatsoever of two key SS witnesses Trevor Roper claimed to have interviewed in the preparation of his report. Other very important witnesses were well beyond his reach in Soviet prison camps and during their incarceration gave statements quite different from ones attributed to them by Trevor Roper and his followers.